मनोबुद्ध्यहङ्कारचिन्तानि नाहि न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातु न वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप
Chidananda Rupa
शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं 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 मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचिन्तानि नाहं न च श्रोत्र जिह्वे न च घ्राण नेत्रे न च व्योम भूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानंद रूप शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं न च प्राणसंज्ञो न वै पञ्चवायु न वा सप्तधातून वा पञ्चकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं न मे द्वेषरागौ न मे लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखं न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोहं शिवोहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासं ಸ್ವರ್ಗತಂ ನೈವ ಮುಕ್ತೇನ ಮೇಯ ಚಿದಾನಂದ ರೂಪ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಚಿದಾನಂದ ರೂಪ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಚಿದಾನಂದ ರೂಪ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಶಿವೋಹಂ ಚಿದಾನಂದ ರೂಪ ಶಿವೋಹಂ 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 ಶಿವೋಹಂ
Welcome to our last class in this series on the Anavatapaya chapter of the Shiva Sutras. It is the final class in this series of the Splendid Path classes, but it's not the end. For one thing, we have another week of practice. We're going to keep the listserv open through the holidays. And also, several people have mentioned that they haven't had a chance to fully do the homework because I've been sending out so much. So I'm just going to suggest that you continue working with the homework assignments, not only the ones from this coming week, but the ones from the previous weeks, because most of them are practices that we really can do in moments when we want to sit down and turn within. You can use one of these practices. You can continue the contemplations, certainly the meditations. And in my experience with these practices that arise in the context of our classes, of our tantra classes, of our jnana yoga classes, they all seem to come out of the vortex of awakening energy that is created through the interaction of you guys with the text, with the lineage shakti that so powerfully moves through the text. So don't leave the homework in your mailbox or on the piece of paper which you've downloaded, but actually dip into them, use them. And I can promise you that if you have a very busy holiday season, which I know some of you do, that dipping into one of these contemplations and certainly into the meditation will be an enormous way to practice self-care. Every magazine and newspaper that I read is filled with tips about holiday self-care. Well, practicing the non-dual teachings and contemplations from the Shiva Sutras is the best self-care that I know. So before we do our initial mantras and meditation, I'd just like to start by acknowledging what an intense week it's been for those of you in the Sangam who participate in the listserv. You know, so many of us have been touched by genuine empathy in contemplating the passing of Jennifer's daughter and also the passing of Tessa Majors, which Michelle brought so personally to our attention. And yet, even as we grieve for them, and even as these specific griefs remind us of how much there is to grieve about in the world at this moment, I have also seen that many of you have really been called to Shiva's perspective in the course of this, and I want to speak to that. You know, Shiva's perspective, of course, is that nothing really dies. But beyond that, that if we fully enter into our pain and sadness, and in fact every other experience that we can have in these bodies, we'll discover that at the root of all of it, there's ecstasy, because nothing that occurs in this world is separate from the ecstasy of Shiva Shakti. And, you know, I know this is not particularly comforting when we've lost someone or something precious, or when we are in extreme physical pain. But it's still true. And if we remember it, not to use as a spiritual bypass, but to use as a prompt to really go beyond the surface and even our deeper emotions to the impulse behind them, we recognize that, as all the traditions say, the soul is immortal, it's able to transcend the body at death, but it also opens us to the far more radical vision that is Shiva's vision, because, you know, when we're able to see, even for a moment, that nothing and no one is ever separate from the great light of consciousness, meaning that nothing is ever separate from Shiva Shakti, it's not just that nothing can ever be lost, it's also that even in loss, we're being inundated by the love at the core of this universe. And of course, I want to say that doesn't mean we shouldn't grieve or that we shouldn't honor our grief. Of course we should. You know, and more than that, I've found that it's really important to experience grief as a sharp, full, immersive experience. Not to hang on to it, but to let ourselves be fully present with the felt state that arises when it arises. It's not just that grief passes through us only if we allow ourselves to feel it, but it's also true that when we work with grief in the tantric way, we can have the opportunity to feel the energy in intense emotions so strongly that they'll penetrate the layers of dullness around the heart, and in that moment give us an intimation of truth. So in that regard, I want to read aloud the poem that Barry sent into the listserv yesterday, which I know many of you read and commented on, but it really speaks to this point, and it's a point that we're going to work with through a couple of the sutras later on in this time. So this is Barry's poem, Chidananda Rupa Shivoham Shivoham. I felt the pain of Wendy and Jennifer and Michelle and Tessa's parents and friends. I felt the pain of people in my community who recently lost loved ones. I felt it enter my mouth as I swallowed. It came to a place on my spine, a place behind the lum point in the spine, a place where a sparkling orgasmic energy spreads throughout my body. Here I was, eating pain and feeling it transmute to pleasure. Shivoham, Shivoham. So in her very beautiful poetic sharing, we see that grief, although it is many things, it is a door. And there was a moment that I've always remembered that I witnessed during satsang with a teacher that I used to spend time with. One of her students had come to see her after a long time, and this man's wife, who was also a student, had passed away a few weeks before after a long illness. And as he told his teacher about the event, he began to weep and to explain how broken and sad he felt, even after after the many months of caring for his wife and the pain of her passing, which wasn't going away. And his teacher listened, and then she said something that shocked me and certainly shocked him. She said quite sharply, "Why do you forget the truth in the midst of your pain?" Now, I think everyone who heard her was stunned. The room fell silent. And you could see that people were wondering, as I was wondering, how could she be so unsympathetic? And later the man described this event to me, and he said that when he first heard her remark, he felt kind of gut-punched, like she hadn't realized how much pain he was in. And then, because he was a yogi, he started to contemplate what she might have meant. And the first thing that arose was that as he thought about the months surrounding his wife's death, he began to remember the love that had poured into her from so many friends during her illness, and the support and prayers and different kinds of assistance that had come from the community in the months since. And he realized that the thought that his teacher was talking about, the truth that his teacher was talking about, is the truth of love, the truth of kindness, the truth of connection, which is stronger and more powerful even than pain. And in the midst of his grief, he opened to this very sacred feeling of gratitude. And that's a very, really exquisite realization. And if you think deeply into what his teacher had said to him, you might also realize that she was pointing to something that's even deeper and more radical, which is, of course, that his wife's essence had not died, not only because her soul is immortal, but because the consciousness that inhabited her living form cannot be created and destroyed, but simply transformed, and that though all things change, the one intelligent love that is its source is unaffected by change, and that that state is the core of every one of us. So as emotions play, and they will, and they should, because experiencing emotions is part of what it is to be a human being, and I believe it's actually part of why Shakti chose to take form as mammals, you know, as beings capable of experiencing emotions. So as we hold that and chant and meditate and feel our connection to each other, let's see if we can, as the tantric sages do, hold the exquisite paradox that everything is completely real and that everything is also a passing illusion, and recognize that both are true, and that in the meeting of reality and illusion really is the birthplace of our connection to love. So find your posture and remember that in the posture, it's always very important to begin by breathing into the base and letting the buttocks and the sits bones get heavy and ground, letting the life force in the prana actually enliven the base of your posture, and then flow upward through the center, up through the crown, and feel how when you do this vertical breath, grounding through the sits bones and rising through the crown, every other part of your body also kind of wiggles into alignment. And see if you can feel the crown of your head aligned with the triangle made by the sits bones and the pubic bone at the base of your posture. Your shoulder blades align and melt over your back, and you can let your chest rise from that point in the sternum that actually governs our capacity to hold an upright posture in a relaxed way. Your face is soft, and as you begin the chant, we'll start, of course, with the mantras to Ganesha, then the Mahamrityunjaya mantras, the invocation to the great conqueror of death, to the Dakshinamurti shloka, the invocation to Shiva as the guru, and finally the invocation to the primordial goddess, the Devi who has become all this. And we'll take a big breath together. If you like, you can bring your hands into Anjali Mudra, and we'll chant Om, and then segue right into the Ganesha mantras. Om. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Om Ganganapataye Namaha. Vakratunda Mahakaya Koti Surya Sumaprabha Nirviknam Kurume Deva Sarva Karyeshu Sarvada. And three Mahamrityunjaya mantras. Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. Om Trayambakaya Jamahe Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshiyam Amritat. And the Dakshinamurti Shloka. Gurave Sarvalokanam Visaje Bhavaroginam Nidhaye Sarva Vidyanam Dakshina Murtaye Namaha. I bow to the Guru of all worlds, to the physician who cures all worldly ills, to the ocean of all wisdom, to Dakshina Murti Shiva, the Lord who initiates us into the highest truth, and to the Goddess. Sarva Mangala Mangalye Shive Sarvatra Sadike Sharanye Trayambake Gauri Narayani Namostute. Om. So as you freshen your posture, bring yourself into the felt sense of connection with the community. This community which has deepened and expanded through this class really is a coming together of each other's most loving, most enlightened, most expansive qualities. We're allowed to be that self with each other in this company. And it really is part of the grace of the Sangham. Remember also that as we invoke those aspects of ourselves and each other, we also connect with the soul of the universe, which is the soul living in each one of us in a unique form, but never disconnected. So begin to feel the breath flowing in from above, flowing as a stream of scintillating blue light that arises from a region high above your crown, unseeable and unknowable, but radiating life force, this blue light of utter, absolute, enlivening Shakti through your crown. And let yourself feel that it flows from the heart of the universe, from the Mahadevi, the great goddess, from Shiva, her consort. And as the light flows in from above, you feel it flowing down through your brain and into your heart. And feel the light filling your heart, activating the great blue lake of consciousness. Inhaling and exhaling, you allow yourself to feel the breath radiating across the lake of the heart, the lake of consciousness, the lake of pure awareness, throbbing, vibrating with radiance and depth. And now bring your awareness to the base of the spine, the area right in front of the coccyx. And this time, inhale with the feeling that the breath flows in down through the crown all the way to the base of the body. And with the exhalation, deep scarlet light rises up from this space at the base of the body up to the center and joins like a stream of scarlet radiance, joins the blue lake at the heart. So you're inhaling blue radiance from above the crown into the heart, exhaling that radiance back up to the crown, and then inhaling down into the region just below the coccyx and exhaling scarlet radiance from the center of earth into the heart. And gradually you allow the lake in the heart, which is manifesting as a deep purple radiance, the purple of royalty, the purple of the most exquisite recognition of preciousness. The purple light of the heart is also the light of the highest chakra. And as you center your attention in this lake of radiance that is your heart, you once again recognize that all of us are seated around this lake, which is within each of us and also within all of us, which is the consciousness that we share. We are both the individuals who gaze at the lake and the lake itself. So imagine that you light a candle and set it on the lake. And then let yourself sit in the presence of the lake of the heart, of the flames that float on it. And you may in this meditation feel as though you yourself float on the lake, or even for some of you, that you actually are immersed in the center of the lake itself. Or you may experience yourself peacefully sitting at the edge of the lake, surrounded by the subtle forms of each of us, watching the scintillating radiance and the flames that float upon it. Now, I want to ask you as you listen, and hopefully we're going to have time for some questions as well, see if you can begin to feel, at least at moments, as though the breath is flowing in and out through the pores. It's in this particular breath, this particular experience of feeling the body as a kind of an open, energetic space that can draw breath in through every particle of itself, that we actually start to be able to really become comfortable in dissolving the feeling of boundaries. Certainly, this is something that's very helpful to do in meditation and very helpful to do in receiving the insight that flows from the sutras. And what you have probably noticed in this class and in the one we did this summer is that the Shiva Sutras is definitely not a linear text. It actually has a circular quality to it. It's especially the Anavapaya chapter. The sutras are constantly circling around several major points that are described from different points of view. And my experience of it, especially of my encounter with the Anavapaya Sutras, which I have actually encountered more deeply in this during this class than I have before, mainly because when I teach, I usually teach the first two books. And one reason that I was inspired to teach this course was because it gives me an excuse to really read through the Anavapaya texts. The sutras here are, you know, there are many sutras here that teachers, including myself, pluck out of the text to explain. And I had somehow envisioned that we were going to actually go point by point and cover all the sutras, which, as usually happens, turned out to be impossible because several of the sutras really presented themselves to me and hopefully to you as warranting deep study, deep explanation. So we've tended to focus, you know, on a few sutras. And one of the reasons that I feel that that's okay is because actually the way this chapter is constructed is that it is constantly returning to several major points. And so I wanted to start tonight by just calling some of the main points that we encountered in this series and that also we encountered in the summer class on book one and two. So here are some of them. Number one, of course, your true self is consciousness, Chaitanya, free and untouched. And that means it's free of any attributes, of any identification, whether with the body or your thoughts or your opinions. Its nature is creative, and therefore it is actually the source of all the worlds that are created by that consciousness in the macrocosm, but also of the worlds that are created within our individual experience, both our inner worlds of thoughts and feelings and images and fantasies and dreams, and also the external world that we experience as the objects of our awareness. All of this is actually being created by the primordial Shakti of your consciousness, which is Shiva's consciousness. Three, our ideas, all of our ideas about these worlds and ourselves that stem from identification with anything, so to speak, personal, are intrinsically false, even though they might be accurate descriptions of what we can experience through the senses and, you know, and of what we can see through the mind. They are false simply because they limit our ability to experience the vastness that is our own source and that is the reality behind all this. Four, your individual awareness and your individual experience of love, when freed from identification with the body and mind, expand through grace into full recognition of the identity of your awareness and the identity of your love with the divine source. Number five, this is said in all the books, and it's very important teaching in the tantras. Words bind us. Thoughts keep us stuck. But if we can understand that all words, thoughts, ideas are expressions of Shakti, then we can use the intrinsic power in words to liberate us from that bondage. Number six, remember this is the first sutra of the Anavapaya Sutras. As an individual, we are defined by the state of our own mind. And in such a state, when you're allowing yourself to be defined by what you think and feel, whatever you think you know is binding. By dissolving, so this is number seven, by dissolving your identification with the density of your body and the density that we experience in the mind and senses, through the mind and senses, consciousness will naturally expand back into its source. And what I want to say here is that it's our identification with the body as well as our identification with thoughts that keep us stuck. The density of the body and the play of thoughts are natural. They're actually expressions of Shakti. But when we believe that they are us, that's when we get stuck in them. Eight, through the practices of meditation and expansion of the center between the breaths, the still point between the breaths, which is also experienced as the still point of the central channel in the inner body. So through these practices, we realize the awakened consciousness that is the source of all experience, which is known as Turiya, the fourth state, the ever-present awareness that is the divine within us. And nine, by expanding our connection with that awareness, awareness begins to permeate not only our inner world, but also our external experience. And we then realize that everything is within our consciousness. And that state of not only recognizing consciousness as me, but also recognizing consciousness as everything else, that state is tantric realization. So number 10, an advanced yogi is one who is fully identified with the divine source and can exercise the innate freedom and power of that source. And that means that whatever he or she says and does is imbued with the power of that source. We'll speak more about that later on. So, tantric self-realization, in other words, is the healing of the split between the knower and the known. The knower and the known, remember, are both consciousness. But what it is to be bound is to feel that I am and the objects which I interact with are different. You know, the I am in Sanskrit is called the aham. The objects are called the idam or this, and this recognition of aham as not different than idam is the experience, which may be momentary or may be permanent, of realization of the truth. So the aham, as you probably have recognized, has several levels. So the egoic aham is the I identified with the personal self, with the body, the emotions, with our history. The true aham is consciousness without an object. And the ultimate experience of aham, the experience that in Sanskrit is called shu-oham, my eye is not different from the divine eye, the ultimate experience of aham includes the realization that everything you can experience is part of you. So, and in this recognition, you realize that everything that can be known, all objects of knowledge, all objects of consciousness, including your body and your personal self, will eventually dissolve, die, disappear. But the subject, the aham, the I, never dissolves. It never dies. It is never destroyed. And that recognition is the heart of the yogi self-realization. So in the Anava Upaya Sutras, the sutrakar, the author, traces and retraces, refers again and again to the experience of the yoga practitioner who enters the Turiya state, is brought out of it by the force of maya, taking the form of thoughts and emotions arising, and then re-enters it again. Part of the, I think, gift of sadhana in the tantric tradition is that it involves really getting to know all the different movements of our consciousness, because we experience them so many times. And of course, learning to recognize the Turiya state, the state of expanded awareness when it arises, and to also be present to the extraordinary freshness of each immersion in the meditative state. When we make a commitment to practicing sadhana in this way, which is to say a commitment to practicing sadhana as a lifelong journey, we often don't know how challenging it will be to practice in the midst of intense pain and intense pleasure. And, you know, we forget the truth, not only in the midst of pain, but also in the midst of watching a really engrossing TV show, or in the midst of our concern about the political upheavals and, you know, in our country and around the world, or in all the, you know, distracting situations that come about through our relationships and our different interconnections with the physical and social world. So, and the Anava Upaya Sutras keep reminding us again and again, kind of the carrot and the stick approach to sadhana. They remind us to remember the extraordinary potency that we experience when our sadhana matures, and also the precariousness of awakened states. So, we were saying this last week, that even an experienced practitioner can forget that the real self is not the body, but the knower of the body. Even when we have unmistakable experiences of the self in meditation, we still forget it, often 20 minutes after we've come out of meditation. And when we do, Shiva says, no matter how advanced we may be, we still are going to get tossed around by the events of our lives. And that's normal. That's natural. That's not because we're failure. It's because Shakti, in her form as Maya, is pretty much all-powerful. So the Shiva Sutras is entirely about, you know, giving us pointers into recognizing the truth of our own consciousness, recognizing that the consequence of forgetting is suffering, knowing your own tendencies well enough so that you can use every experience as a wake-up call. And when I say use every experience as a wake-up call, I mean specifically use your experiences of discomfort as a wake-up call, as reminders to turn back to the awareness that knows we're experiencing pleasure and pain, to remember the sacred truth that our own awareness is divine, and to look at the world from that perspective so that we can begin to see that our consciousness is present in everything and that nothing is outside of our consciousness. And I do think that this is an extremely empowering recognition. I know that for me, it's been kind of the thread that I've been able to hold on to through many, many ups and downs in the course of my life. And, you know, to realize that any suffering or discomfort we experience, whether it's guilt or negative thoughts or a difficult relationship, can be used as a reminder to practice. Not to forget the truth, as the teacher I mentioned earlier said, not to forget the truth in the midst of our pain, or in the midst of our pleasure, or in the midst of our confusion. I've found, as I hope you have also, that having a strong foundation in Anavapaya practice actually creates the template within which true remembrance can happen. And as we do, as we work with Anavapaya practices, we start to realize that every time we remember, we're earning. We're literally earning, as my guru used to say, putting money in the bank of sadhana. So we're accumulating earnings that will make it more and more possible to return. So, you know, our ability to witness and work with emotions is earned by remembering to practice it, to discern the difference between what we're conditioned to believe and reality, the actual felt experience of the present moment, is earned every time we remember to bring our consciousness, to bring our attention into the now. Every time you remember to sense awareness as the living presence at the root of your mind, you're literally earning the ability to do that more easily the next time. And every time you turn it within, which most of us have had to practice over and over again to be able to actually do it, we're earning a deeper facility with turning within. So inner consciousness becomes more and more toned, more and more tuned to its source every time we refresh it. So again, I want to talk about this because the sutras do it all the time. Because the truth of awareness love is so subtle and so easily gets covered up by conceptual ideas and the whole display that Maya and her Matrika Shaktis create in the field of the mind, we practice to just kind of remind ourselves that the truth is there. You know, in certain states, we can turn directly into the self as awareness, the self as bliss, because we're feeling joy or we're feeling kind of a witnessing state, and we know how to use these aspects of our limited experience to guide us back. You know, in other states, when we're a little more confused or, you know, a little more stuck, we actually need to go step by step, you know, to literally to rescue ourselves from ingrained patterns of suffering. And the Anavapaya teachings offer a range of tools that are intended to help us do this. So my hope really is that part of the fruit of this class is that you've learned to have confidence in these concentrative practices, to realize that even if it takes a little while to get fluent in them, that practice pays off and it becomes easier. And then it becomes more and more attractive to turn to them. So we're going to meditate, and we'll do this in several different ways in the course of this evening's class. We're going to meditate on a practice that we started last week, which is the practice of breathing from the heart to the region above the Sahasrara. This is a practice that's called Uchara, which, you know, actually refers to the quality of prana, of the inner life force at the root of the breath. It refers to the ability of prana to rise, to take the to take consciousness into higher and subtler states. So find your posture and find your straight-backed, relaxed, erect sitting posture. And you may want to find the points that we're meditating with by putting one hand, let's say your left hand, over the center of the chest and your right hand about two fists above the crown, which, as you know, is the space of the upper Dwadashanta, the upper space of 12, or the space of the upper Sahasrara. I want to say something that this text keeps telling us again and again, that when consciousness actually rises to that place and gets stabilized there, that we are said to be in the state known as unmani, that is, the space beyond the mind. So it's very much the doorway into the higher forms of samadhi. And whether, you know, in the short periods that we're meditating here, you actually enter that space, you certainly are fully equipped to enter it in longer spaces of meditation, as several of you have shared. So, with your eyes closed, become present to the space behind the breastbone and the space above the crown. Inhale with the feeling that the breath flows from above down through the center of the head and throat into the heart. And then for just a fraction of a second, hold your breath and feel that the mantra Om Shrim Hrim rises up through the center of the body and merges in the crown. Now, I was probably talking too long to let you actually hold your breath comfortably, so I'll give you the instruction again, and then I'll just be silent and let us practice it. So inhaling down into the heart from above, hold the breath, and just for a second or two, feel that the mantra Om Shrim Hrim rises swiftly up to the center of the body, merges in the crown, and let the breath flow in, down to the heart. Hold the breath in the heart, and let the mantra rise. So at your own pace, allow the inhalation to flow in from above to the heart. Let the breath become still there. And let the mantra Om Shrim Hrim rise up to the crown. And allow the inhalation to flow back down to the heart. If you feel tight or any strain in this practice, it's okay to not hold the breath, but actually to allow the breath to flow down to the heart and then actually breathe up towards the crown. So it's very important in this practice that you not get uncomfortable or stressed. Inhaling from the crown, holding the breath for a second or two in the heart, if that's comfortable, as the mantra rises, Om Shrim Hrim, up through the crown. allow your attention to center in the space above the crown. The breath is still flowing, and there is no need to hold the breath. And there in the crown, with your awareness in this space above the crown, just for a moment, allow yourself to feel that this upper space is a vast sky irradiated with light. And that subtly present in this sky is a knowingness, an awareness, a subtle consciousness. Which is Shiva. And then with the next inhalation, feel the breath flowing down from the crown into the heart. And once again, flowing vertically from the heart to the crown with Om Shrim Hrim. And with the next inhalation, see if you can allow your attention to settle in the heart. And with your attention in the heart, say to yourself the following truth. I am doing the sadhana of Shiva. I am Shiva. My practice is Shiva. And all the instruments of my practice are Shiva. I do the sadhana of Shiva. I recognize I am Shiva. My practice is Shiva. All the instruments of my practice are Shiva. There's nothing inside and outside that is not Shiva. So in Anava Upaya Sadhana, we are doing these quite specific concentrative practices, most of which involve the breath, because really the heart of Anava Upaya, of the sadhana of an individual, is your cultivation of the breath. But even though we're doing these concentrative practices, which are in many cases classical yogic practices, we're doing it always with the recognition that of non-duality. That in other words, even though you are practicing, you're making an effort, that the effort that you're making is understood to not be your personal effort, but really to be the movement of Shiva's Shakti, the movement of grace flowing through you. And it is that constant willingness to remember, oh, okay, there's no separation here. Everything that I'm experiencing is being experienced as the divine, in the divine. Even my unsuccessful efforts are in the divine, and that's really the essentially liberating understanding of Shaivism, which we can practice even when we're in a completely dualistic state, when we're completely feeling separate. We can still remember it. As we said last week, much of this part of the text is devoted to explaining what the experience of a realized yogi really looks like and feels like. So many of the sutras will talk about what it is to actually have realized this truth. And in it, there are some sutras that describe this state of a realized yogi, but which we also can apply to ourselves, because very much of the reason that we study these texts is not to become discouraged because our state hasn't reached those heights, not only to be inspired by the possibilities, but also to use these sutras as a prompt to practice as if you are having this experience. So, for example, one of the very significant sutras that I learned in my tradition, because it so much describes what the experience is of being around an enlightened being. One of the sutras says, even the Sanskrit goes katha japaha. Ordinary talk, even the gossip of an enlightened being is mantra. You know, and what it says is that when we are really poised in the awareness that what flows through our body mind is God consciousness, what we also realize is that the breath is constantly doing mantra. And the mantra that the breath does, as you will remember, because we've studied this together and you've studied it on your own, the breath is always doing japa, is always reciting mantra. As the breath flows out, it makes the sound sa. As the breath flows in, it makes the sound sa. And so not only the realized being, but you and I, the commentary in the sutra says, are constantly reciting mantra just in the course of life, so that as you follow the breath and listen to the sound of the breath, you're performing what's called the unstruck japa, the unspoken japa. And if you're aware of it, if you actually can hear the breath, recognize the breath in this way, then that experience of I am that, which is the meaning of Hamsa, actually permeates everything in your life, including your conversation. And this recognition, this ability to remember that the breath is always saying this mantra, Hamsa, is actually one of the main anava upaya recognitions that we hold on to in those moments when we have fallen out of turiya, when we're not aware of turiya. So the state of the realized yogi as it's described, as it's ultimately described in the Shiva Sutras, is that it's a state of mastery over the activity of the energies that run your life. So if you remember, the Shaiva texts talk about the Shakti Chakras, the groups of energies, the groups of cosmic energies, whose function it is to constantly create the experience of separation and difference. So the Shakti Chakras are described very vividly in the Sri Vidya tradition, in which the divine is identified as the great goddess, as the Mahadevi. As many of you know, the great goddess has a retinue of lesser goddesses. It's one of the interesting differences between the Shaiva, between the tradition of which calls the divine Shiva and which calls the divine Shakti, because Shiva has no parts. Shiva is simply one vast consciousness. Shakti has innumerable forms, one of which is your body. But on the cosmic level, these Shaktis have a specific role in manifesting the forms and currents of energy in the physical world. And these Shaktis play as the thoughts in your mind, as the physical world, as the senses, and the tantric realizer is aware of the play of these Shaktis and is able to control them, which is a very big deal, as you know, because it means not only that she is able to control her own mind and her own tendency to be drawn by, various desires and impulses, and to be taken out of herself, taken out of himself by the senses when our eyes and ears are open. So the tantric realizer can control his or her own experience of the way the Shaktis play through the mind and emotions and senses, but can also control the way the Shaktis manifest in the greater world. And for that reason, such a being is constantly able to intervene in the state of the people who come close to him or come close to her. That is, to literally kindle knowledge of the self, knowledge of the truth in anyone who spends time with them. And this ability to transmit a deeper awareness is actually not just the ability of a fully self-realized being. It's something that you also begin to experience as you become more deeply in touch with your own consciousness, with your sense of self, and your awareness that your own self, your own deep self, is also the space within which you're experiencing the world. And what that means is that the people around you, the people who come into your field, will often experience a kind of natural upliftment, which is essentially what your friends are talking about when they say, "What happened to you? You seem so peaceful and it feels good to be around you." So we are actually, even in our not fully enlightened state, we also participate in the experience of heightened consciousness that is fully unfolded in someone who is completely realized. The difference, of course, between us and that fully enlightened being is that we're not able to all the time hold our mastery of the Shaktis. So the images and dreams, the thoughts in the mind, our interactions with the external world, and even the the void of deep sleep actually block us from realizing the pure truth. It's only in Turiya, the awakened experience, the moments of awakened experience, that consciousness clearly sees itself. And the hallmark of a realized being is simply that he or she has unrestricted access to Turiya, both in and out of meditation. So Turiya is, you know, there are many characteristics of Turiya. One is extreme clarity, a sense that everything flows. But mainly, the experience of Turiya is that the split between subject and object largely dissolves. In other words, we may be very conscious of the objects that we see and hear and smell and taste, of the diversity of the external world and the thoughts arising in our mind. But we also can see very clearly that everything knowable is being experienced within the overall awareness that we call consciousness. So for most of us, the experience of this state is a very big deal. But, you know, and the initial, our meditation is really all about learning to be comfortable, learning to enter this state and to be comfortable there. And, you know, for many of us in meditation, as we were saying last week, our entrance into Turiya may be very, very brief. But as we advance, as we become more open to it, and we realize that, as these sutras say, it's possible to live in it, what we begin to be able to do is to access Turiya with our eyes open, initially just in the first moments after meditation, at the end of meditation, before we fully entered the waking state. We also begin to notice that in the moments between sleep and waking, we are experiencing this kind of clarity of being. So this capacity to enlarge, to expand our meditative awareness when we're not in meditation is very critical to the development of our consciousness. And I want to say that this does not mean that we try to hang on to meditative states or that we walk around being spaced out. It's a kind of natural recognition of the connection between our own consciousness and whatever is around us. And in Sutra 23, Lakshmanju talks about, it's in Sutra 23 and 24, Lakshmanju talks about the rather frustrating experience of an intermediate level tantric yogi when he or she has experienced a state of meditation, a state of expanded consciousness, and then finds that he or she can't hold it. And this is the way he describes it. This is a quote from the Malini Vijaya Tantra that's in the commentary. Lakshmanju is paraphrasing it. He says, due to the impressions he has of what others think of him or expect of him, and of his wanting to help others, does this sound recognizable to you, to satisfy them with boons, he may lose his temper and become careless and uneven-minded, blocking his flow of God consciousness from the center of his three states of waking, dream, and deep sleep. So even though he is aware of God consciousness in the beginning, that is, in the moments before waking or the moments coming out of meditation, he is played by the universe during most of the waking and dream experience, played by hunger, played by thirst, played by every aspect of daily life. Therefore, he says, one who desires to achieve the highest state of being should remember not to get attached to these outer impressions. But in verse 24, in Lakshmanju's translation, it's said that even when ordinary egoically identified states of consciousness arise and you are being totally played by your mind and senses and the world, you can practice seeing the self in the world. And this is the, you know, the heart of Anava Upaya, wake open-eyed tantric practice. So you do this by, you begin to do this by creating a strong intention that you're going to remember to discern the self, not only by keeping a part of your consciousness indrawn, a part of your consciousness in the heart, a part of your consciousness on the witness, a part of your consciousness flowing with the breath up and down the central channel, but you also remember to, let's say, at least intellectually recognize that what you see and hear and taste and smell is actually made of God consciousness. And this clue is in Sutra 24. The Sanskrit is Matra Swapratyaya Sandane Nashtasya Punarutanam. When a yogi coming out of meditation also attempts to maintain awareness of God consciousness, of the deep awareness in the objective world, then even though his real nature as the self is covered by the states of egoic consciousness, he can again rise into that supreme nature of the self. And when he says he can again rise, what he means is that you and I can kindle this state in ourselves anytime we seriously try to remember it. And this is how the Swachanda Tantra, which again is quoted very much in Kshema Raja's commentary, describes this particular form of contemplation. And many of you will recognize this. It says, whatever is perceived through the eyes, whatever becomes an object of consciousness through words, speech, or thought, whatever the mind thinks of, including pleasure, profit, etc., whatever the intellect discerns, whatever you understand to be yourself, whatever exists as an object of awareness, even what does not exist but which is only imagined, one should actively attempt to discover the divine presence in all this. Whatever is perceived through the eyes, whatever becomes an object of awareness through words, whatever the mind thinks of, whatever the intellect discerns, whatever is understood to be yourself, whatever exists as an object of awareness, even what is only imagined, in all of this, one should actively attempt to discover the divine presence. Now, some of you may know a little book from the mystical Christian tradition called The Practice of the Presence of God. It's in the form of a letter from an old monastic, and his entire practice, he works in the monastery kitchen. His entire practice is to feel that God is present with him during his work. And this letter, which is to a young monk, in this letter he explains that he never does contemplation, he never does formal prayer, he never goes to the choir, the monastery choir. All he does is work. But throughout the day, he feels God present with him. And I've always found this to be one of the most powerful open-eyed practices there is. It's, you know, it's dualistic in the sense that Brother Lawrence, which is the name of this monk, is imagining God as an other, as a being, a separate being. He's not, at least not consciously, recognizing that divine consciousness is also his own consciousness. But given the fact that most of us are experiencing some form of duality most of the time, a practice like this is a gorgeous way to find the sacred and ordinary daily experience. So close your eyes. Allow your attention to linger on the edges of your body. That is, Feel into the sensation of your clothes touching your skin, the air against your face, the sensation of the body against the seat, the sensation of the hair on your head, and perhaps also you'll become aware of the space around your body. And now, using the faculty of imagination, just reframe your experience of sensation so that you feel that all these sensations are the goddess embracing you. She's embracing you as your clothes. She is hugging you as the air. Every sensation that you can be aware of is the touch of the goddess. And as you allow yourself to tune in to the sensations of your natural experience as the presence of goddess, notice how enlivened your sensations become. And begin to expand your experience of sensation. Such that you begin to be conscious of how there really is no border between the felt sensations at the edge of your body and whatever space you're in. See if you can allow the sensation of being touched, being held, to penetrate through your skin so that the goddess enters you as the sensation of breath flowing through the nostrils and also flowing through the pores. In your sense of sensation, the sense of subtle touch that is so much a part of our normal sensory experience, see if you can feel that through sensation, goddess is loving you open. And recognize that even when your mind and senses are telling you that you're a separate being interacting with a world of separate objects and beings, nonetheless, through this sensation of touch as goddess, you can feel divine presence within and around you. So we're looking at the clues that the sutras, especially Kshema Raja's commentaries on the sutras, offer us as they talk about the qualities of enlightened beings. And I want to talk about Sutra 38, which relates to what we were talking about earlier in the class, the very beginning of the class, reading Bari's poem about pain and ecstasy. The Sanskrit of Sutra 38 is very simple. It says, Tripad Adi Anupranam. Tripad literally means the three states, meaning waking, dream, and deep sleep. Adi refers to the original face of the truth, the original source of our experience, which is to say Shakti. So Adi is one of the names for the primordial Swatantriya Shakti, the supremely creative cosmic energy, whose nature, as Kshema Raja says, whose nature is bliss. So the word Adi is referencing the innate bliss of Shakti. Anupranam means to enliven a part with the energy of the whole. Anu is the part. Prana means life force. So, see, we always come back to the prana in the Anava Upaya Sutras. So the translation says the three states should be enlivened by the originator, the Swatantriya Shakti, who's the source of these states. So how do you enliven your three states in this way? You actually do it by linking moments of heightened intensity. And in this sutra, the sutra is talking specifically about moments of bliss or moments of love. But it also applies to more unpleasant moments. So you do it by linking these intense moments with the primordial Shakti and using these experiences as doorways. So the tantric yogi, the enlightened yogi, knows that moments of enjoyment, moments of contentment, joy, excitement, are flashes of the natural exuberance of Shakti, who, you know, as you may remember, Shakti leaps up. You know, Shakti is urgent in her desire to manifest, in her desire to create. Creativity and creative freedom is her essence, and she's always leaping. And so those moments when we have an intense experience are moments of in which the Shakti is very naturally strong. So the source of that bliss, the fullness of that bliss, is ordinarily veiled by Maya, such that we aren't able to really recognize that our little experiences of happiness are actually the great bliss of Shakti in a somewhat limited form. And of course, what we do is we normally associate happiness or blissfulness or ecstasy or excitement with a particular moment or with a sensual experience, and then it's there and then it's gone. But if instead you remember that your individual moments of bliss are limited forms of Shakti's radical joy, then you can use these moments of joy as doorways into the heart of the Shakti. So whenever you feel an uprush of pleasurable energy during sensory experience, you remember that the source of your joy is the primordial bliss of Shakti, and then you turn into the feeling of bliss, like letting go of the circumstances that aroused it, and just feeling it. And then even though the bliss may be momentary, if you seize it, it'll open and expand consciousness and shift your self-sense by putting you in touch with Shakti's presence. And before we do it, I just want to expand a little bit on what Kshema Raja points out in the commentary, in which he, of course, quotes from three of the most famous verses in the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra, which I know many of you are familiar with. And if you remember these verses, they ask us to meditate on the energy at the heart of intense sensory pleasure. In one of these verses, one of the famous Vijnanabhairava verses says that intense sexual excitement and orgasm are direct experiences of Shakti. And specifically, when you experience strong currents of sexual arousal, and this is even deeply, more deeply true when you have an orgasm, these are actually arising from Kundalini. So, you know, remember, Kundalini is the most focused, concentrated form of the life force. And when Kundalini is at rest, she's at rest in the sexual center. So pretty much all of our experience of physical arousal is actually an experience of Kundalini, and which means that they come from within you. And you know this because they can be activated by remembering them or by fantasizing them. A friend of mine was telling me yesterday that he's just gone through a really difficult divorce, which involved his wife falsely accusing him in court of various transgressions. And he said that even though the relationship has curdled, he still feels love when he remembers the beauty of their early days together, and that he feels this despite the fact that he doesn't care if he never sees her again. In other words, the experience of love that their relationship kindled is still actively alive in us. So normally, you know, we might have a pleasant memory or a sexy fantasy or a loving memory and then turn into regret or sorrow because it's gone, you know, or even anger because the person is no longer with us or because we can't hold on to it. But if we expand the feeling or the memory, then and fully identify with it, then recognize that the feeling is Shakti and really be present with the feeling, we're opening the door to the Turiya state. And that honestly is a really big deal. It's of course the basis of this tantric sexual practice, you know, in its purest form. And it is also the principle of using aesthetic rapture, you know, the experience of appreciation when we hear a song that we love or we relish the first taste of good food. It's usually the first taste. You know, we learn how to focus on the feeling and expand it, and then pleasure becomes a doorway. And I found that this is perhaps, it's one of the very greatest of all the tantric methods for finding the sacred in daily life, because it recognizes that pleasure, which in many yogic traditions is regarded as something that is anathema, antithetical to inwardness, that pleasure is actually a doorway into the source. It's meant to be a doorway to the source, not something to be avoided or something to be enslaved by, but an opportunity to tune into Shakti, which means that when we tune into the heart of pleasure, we're actually activating Kundalini for ourselves in that moment. And basically, it's taking us beyond pleasure and pain to the truth at the heart of it. So I'm going to ask you to do for just a moment, because we have a few other practices that we want to do, for just a moment to allow yourself to have your very, very favorite sexual fantasy or whatever mental practice you may use to kindle a sense of arousal, sexual arousal in yourself. And, you know, I'm offering you to use any method for doing this. And once you begin to feel that spark of arousal, focus fully on it. Focus on the sensation of it. Let go of the fantasy if you have it, if you used a fantasy. Let go of any expectation of anything. And just feel the sensation of pleasure. and imagine yourself diving right into the middle of the sensation. Notice how that sensation expands. It may expand upward into the heart, which is what usually happens to me. It might flow through the body. It might become extremely intense. Just be present with it. You're having a direct experience of Shakti in her form as sense pleasure. And you're very welcome to stay present to that. What I would say is that when we practice tuning into our states of arousal or sensory enjoyment with the recognition that in the sensation of the enjoyment is the Shakti, what we're actually doing is signaling to the primal Shakti. We're sort of saying to her, okay, bring it on. Show me yourself. I'm ready to experience your presence in the physical world and in the emotional world. You know, in an actual awakening, which I would love it if some of you had in these moments, in an actual awakening, this is a complete no-brainer. It's utterly obvious that it's Shakti who's delighting in our experience of the senses. But normally, she conceals this fact, and in remembering it, we are actually inviting her to reveal herself, and in my experience, she really likes that. And the more we do it, the more she's willing to show us her exquisite presence. Now, the same is true of extreme emotional states that are not pleasurable. And that was, of course, the brilliance of Barry's poem that we read earlier. She let herself feel the pain of loss, empathically in that case, and as she entered it, the pain turned into ecstasy. So again, you know, to remind you, one of the most famous sutras in the Vijnana Bhairava, and there's a verse in the Spandakarika, is another tantric text which says the same thing, that the primordial Shakti in all her power is extremely present in states of anger, terror, or confusion, as well as in sexual excitement, and in love, in joy, and that if you turn into these states and focus internally when you're in the midst of intense, difficult emotional moments, it will reveal the intense rasa, the explosive energy of Shakti herself. And she will carry you, as you learn to cultivate those experiences, into the aha of the Shiva state. She'll merge you into Turiya. So this takes cultivation. Doesn't always, so to speak, work. But what I've found over the years as I've practiced with these, you know, these emotional upheavals, it's incredibly powerful and can open you in a moment if the grace is there. So one of the currently popular contemporary takes on non-dual open-eyed practice is from self-help author named Matt Kahn, whom some of you may have read or seen on YouTube, and he apparently had a spontaneous awakening a few years ago while having dinner in a restaurant, during which he saw and felt that everything around him was soaked in love. And this is, of course, a classical mystical experience. It's also a version of the open-eyed samadhi state that the tantras experience, and I know many of you have had your own moments of, you know, this open-eyed samadhi. But Matt then turned this into a practice, which is what I totally encourage all of you to do with your awakened experiences. to do an as-if practice, not to settle for the as-if practice, but to use it. So he wrote a book called Whatever Arises, Love It. And that's basically the open-eyed practice. That it's an open-eyed practice that any of us can do. Maybe many of us do it. You know, and I would add, though it isn't always practical to actively love everything, that it's we can also take the attitude of welcoming whatever arises, of having an attitude of, okay, I welcome this. You know, I welcome this discomfort as a particularly intense form of Shakti, or I welcome this contracted feeling because it's showing me where I'm not free. You know, and so this attitude of welcoming is going to, again, as many of you know, because we've done it in different classes, it's very helpful in meditation, and it can soften your whole experience of life. Another very powerful way to look at the different situations you encounter is to cultivate the feeling of wonder. And this is one of Abhinavagupta's favorite practices. He writes in several places that the mark of a true tantric yogi, meaning an awakened tantrika, is that he approaches everything with a feeling of wonder. And, you know, it's easy to see right now in California. We had our first rains of the season, and within 2 days, green grass sprouted on the dry hillsides. It's totally miraculous. Or one of those, you know, synchronous moments that we might experience, which several people have shared, that, you know, you're thinking about someone and a few minutes later they call you. You can recognize that this is not something to take for granted or to try to figure out, but just experience the wonder of life. And this is it's a very powerful attitude to hold when you're in the midst of events that feel difficult or negative. And I'm thinking specifically of the intense revolutionary anger that is rolling through the world right now and is being expressed through demonstrations in the streets of Iraq and Hong Kong, you know, and Beirut, but also in the partisan, you know, upheavals that were going on during the impeachment hearings and that will probably continue for quite a while. Both sides, you know, no matter which side of the discussion we're on, you know, that there's something wildly over the top about the intensity with which it's being expressed. And you can cultivate wonder at that, at how much Shakti is released in the long simmering issues suddenly explode. And what I find is that if you can approach things that scare you with wonder, rather than giving in to your fear or your judgment or your projections about it all, consciousness will expand. Shakti will come forward. So again, this is a hard one, but I'm just going to ask you to try it. I'm assuming that most of you are aware of the street demonstrations in Hong Kong and Baghdad and Beirut, especially in Hong Kong. They've been all over the news. And see if you can feel your way into those incredibly intense outpourings of anger and the occasional violence that pours through them. And tune into those as an expression of the urge for radical freedom, which is Shakti. So feel your way into the energy of a street demonstration. Let go of any ideas or judgments or hopes about what's going on. Just feel the urgency of the energy, of the desire for freedom, of the human impulse to change things, to rise out of stagnation. And see if you can sense within it the ecstatic urgency of Shakti. And feel wonder. Feel wonder at how intense that urgency, how intensely that urgency can express itself. Now in Sutra 25, which follows these two sutras, describes the ultimate fruit that this kind of open-eyed practice, that is, the intention to see the expansion of consciousness in your sensory experience of the world around you. Sutra 25 says that when a yogi is able to experience the world as an expansion of consciousness, as an expansion of Shakti, when Turiya opens in these moments, and when the yogi is able to retain her connection with the Turiya state, even during times of inner and outer excitement, chaos, upheaval, desire, he becomes like Shiva. The Sanskrit is, it's a really great sutra to remember, and it's easy Sanskrit. Shiva Tulyo Jayate. Shiva Tulyo Jayate. He becomes like Shiva. You know, what it means to become like Shiva in this context is, first of all, to identify with your own awareness. You know, to feel into the experience of I am, this felt sense of being yourself without identifying with any components of the egoic self. And to be able to recognize that your body and everything you perceive through the senses is made of Shakti, is an expression of Shakti. And as you touch more and more deeply into the recognition of your own consciousness as yourself, and recognize that the experience that arises in the so-called exterior world are actually being held in that awareness that is your deepest self. You become in a very real way free. And as we've been saying, the actual realization of this state is not an intellectual experience. It's a total shift of consciousness. So we get that. But the sutra also gives us a way to practice. Because when you are poised in your own sense of I am, identifying as consciousness, you become Shiva-like in that you experience yourself as a stable center around which all the activities of your inner and outer life can be seen to swirl. It's like being, you know, being the maypole with the dancers moving around it. So you become really the central pillar from which you can experience thinking and pain and pleasure as emerging from this center, but not affecting the center. And as that experience, you know, as you combine that recognition of the center with the willingness to recognize your sensations and thoughts and the exterior world as expressions of Shakti, you actually start to recognize at one level or another that everything that comes into your life is an expression of your own inner consciousness. You know, and this is a big topic, which I intend to do a course on in the near future. It's, you know, the recognition that your vision, your inner state, determines what you experience at the outside world, the so-called outside world. Carl Jung intuited this when he spoke about projected shadow, you know, how when we don't own our anger, say, you know, we project it outwardly and we experience other people getting angry at us. His point, which is sometimes hard to accept, but which many of you know, have realized, is that the difficult experiences that come towards you can very often be projections of unowned violence or desire within yourself. And in the same way, when you look around and you see people to admire, very often you're projecting your own light, your own unowned great qualities onto someone else. Of course, we tend to do it especially with teachers or, you know, heroes, though we don't seem to have too many heroes in the contemporary world. But to start to see that when someone or something repels you, that very often the reason you feel repulsion is because they're expressing something in yourself that you haven't quite been willing to own, and that when something attracts you, it's a quality in yourself that's attracting you. This is the first step to realizing that the mood or emotional tone of your inner state really is the filter through which you see the world. And eventually to recognize something that's very, very powerful, to see that everything you experience is a projection of your own mind, and that behind your individual mind, Leia sent in a note to the listserv about her realization of this, behind your individual mind is Shakti, who is actually projecting all of these different worlds of experience through each one of us, through your mind, through your intellect, through your senses. And that's when it starts to become apparent that all the events of your life, everything that you experience inside and outside, is Shakti trying to show you how creative your own consciousness really is. And this is basically the recognition that begins to give you the ability to experience consciousness in everything. A friend of mine was once on a plane that dropped several thousand feet in midair before righting itself. She was a mantra practitioner, and she'd been repeating her mantra during the flight. And when the plane dropped, of course, she was completely terrified. But then she opened her eyes, and she saw that the entire cabin had dissolved its materiality, and that the plane and the people around her were revealing themselves as completely composed of particles of light, particles of consciousness. And she said that in that instant, in that vision, which lasted for about 5 minutes, she was able to see with her open eyes that the underlying reality of all the matter on the plane and in herself and in the people was actually immaterial. And that even if the plane crashed, the dissolution of the matter would not dissolve its essence. So, again, let's practice with the breath. Inhaling and exhaling with the feeling that the breath is flowing in and out of our pores, really relaxing and allowing ourselves to be breathed. inviting through your awareness the breath of the universe, which is Shakti as the life force, to breathe, and through this subtle breath to literally give you life, breath by breath by breath. We all know that we're kept alive by the incoming and outgoing prana. And that we also know that when you hold the breath, you know, I've told this anecdote many times. I used to say to my mother when I got really mad at her, or at least I said this once. I don't think it was a recurring experience. I said to her, okay, I'm going to hold my breath and die. And my mother said to me, you won't be able to do that because if you hold your breath long enough, you'll pass out and then breathing will happen automatically. So in other words, the Shakti of the universe manifesting through the breath is going to keep us alive until that moment when she leaves the body. And in those moments of deep meditative, subtle breathing, which in the yoga text is described, and the Shiva Sutras describe it this way as well, as the even flow of breath, of the inhalation and the exhalation, that when the inhalation and the exhalation settle down, become even, the breath moves into the central channel, the madhya, the sushumna nadi, and the breath stops coming in and out of the nostrils. I know many of you have experienced this in meditation. As meditation deepens, the breath becomes more and more still. And what is happening at that point? This is described in the 43rd Sutra of the Shiva Sutras, Book 3, is that the inner prana, the breath within the breath, which is called pranama, is keeping you alive. The same life force that breathes the child in the womb, you know, where the embryo in the womb doesn't have the apparatus to breathe, but the child is kept alive by the flow of the inner breath, of the pranama, which is Shakti's, as the commentary in the Shiva Sutra says, it's the first movement of the primordial Shakti into materiality. She first expresses herself as this subtle life force, what's called sometimes called the breathless breath. And only then, only later, does she become the prana that moves through the nadis, the ida and pingala nadis, and comes in and out of the nostrils. So what is happening when we go, when we meditate deeply, when our awareness moves into the central channel, when we move into a state of stillness, when Turiya manifests, the breath no longer has to flow in and out of the nostrils. We're simply supported by the inner breath, the pranama, the breath within the breath, which is Shakti herself. And that state of stillness in which you are being breathed is called in the Vijnana Bhairava the force that opens in the central channel. It's called the goddess of the central channel. So that breath, that very subtle, still breath is a form of the goddess. And once we have learned how, through practice and meditation, to center ourselves in that stillness and to come out of it again and go back into it again, the last sutra of the Shiva Sutra says, we repeatedly experience the divine, both inwardly and outwardly. The Sanskrit shloka is Bhuyasyat Pratimilanam. Such a yogi repeatedly experiences the divine, both inwardly and outwardly. And we're talking, of course, about a very advanced state of realization. You close your eyes, you go into meditation, you enter this place of stillness. And when the breath begins to flow through the nostrils again, and you come back into waking consciousness, you are able to see the divine manifesting through your senses with your eyes open. And this is what the commentary says. Absorbed in eye consciousness, she sees the divine inside herself. And then when he turns towards the objective world by opening his eyes, I'm alternating pronouns in case you wonder, he recognizes that there's no difference between the inner world and the outer. And this state, for an advanced yogi, is continuous. You close your eyes, the world dissolves in consciousness. When you open your eyes, the world is experienced in all its diversity, completely one with the light of awareness. And that's the great carrot that the yogic texts lay out for us, and which is really the goal of the Shiva Sutras, to remind us that this is possible, that this is us, and that if we really want to, this is our future. This is what is possible for us. So I want to read you the final statement that Kshema Raja appends to the end of the Shiva Sutras, just explaining what the purpose of his commentary has been. I have placed this commentary on the Shiva Sutra before the public because it is adorned with references from the great texts of the Shaiva tradition. For the sake of destroying the differentiated perception of this universe, let those fortunate people who come in contact with this text relish the nectar of this Shiva Sutra commentary. This Shiva Sutra Vimarshini, this commentary from which flows the secret of Shiva, is filled with that ever new, ever existent nectar and its essence. The glory of this Shiva Sutra commentary is that it has the power to generate curiosity to realize the truth of Shaivism, even in the minds of those who have no curiosity. The glory of this Shiva Sutra's commentary is that it has the power to generate curiosity to realize the truth of Shaivism, even in the minds of those who have no curiosity. It expands and generates a great change in their intellects. By merely tasting this nectar, the fear of birth, old age, and death is removed. The ordinary person, because their consciousness is concealed by the effects of the ego on a limited body in the waking state, the dreaming state, and the state of deep sleep, does not perceive the original state of their own God consciousness, which is great and which belongs to Lord Shiva himself. And when, because of the teaching of the Shiva Sutra Vimarshini, that rare soul realizes that this universe is only existing as congealed foam in the ocean of nectar of universal consciousness, then truly that person has become one with Lord Shiva. And then he says, O fortunate ones, may you immediately cross this ocean of samsara and be established and rooted in the supreme state of God consciousness, which is filled with the nectar of eternal light. This Shiva Sutra, which has come from the mouth of Lord Shiva and which is shining with the real secret of his being, will, by the power of the Master, cause you to quickly overcome differentiated perception. This Shiva Sutra, which has come from the mouth of Lord Shiva and which is shining with the real secret of his being, will, by the magic of the Master, the Masters of this lineage, cause you to quickly overcome differentiated perception of this universe. So, my dear ones, this is the last word of the Shiva Sutras, and it contains a blessing which I think most of you have experienced as real. Certainly, it has been this kind of blessing in my life. And so I want to echo the blessing of Kshema Raja to wish that all of us be inundated with the awareness that flows through these sutras. May it become our deepest experience, and in the absence of direct experience, our deepest longing, because in the desire to experience this, we ensure that the experience will come in this moment or the next, and certainly before you leave this body. This is really what Kshema Raja and Shiva, and of course the primordial Shakti, promise us. So with great love, I want to thank you for being here, and also to remind you that we have an entire week of practice. You'll be getting homework, and hopefully you'll be sharing your experience and your insight on the listserv, which will be open through the holidays, will be open until the end of the year. So, and I will be answering questions on the listserv. So stay in the conversation, and those of you who haven't participated yet, please feel invited into the conversation. It's really the greatest delight of my life to be able to be part of this Sangham. And so I thank you all, and I thank the Shaiva sages, my guru, and the gurus of all of us here. And may the blessings unfold more and more deeply in each of our lives. Namaste. Have a beautiful, beautiful week, holiday season, and know that we'll be together again and again. Namaste.
मनोबुद्ध्यहंकारचेतानि नाहि न च श्रोत्रजिह्वेन च घ्राणनेत्रे न च व्योमभूमि न तेजो न वायु चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूप शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न च
प्राण संज्ञो न वै पंचवायु न वासप्तधातुर्नवा पंचकोशा न वा पाणिपादं न चोपस्थपायु चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न मे द्वेषरागौ लोभमोहौ मदो नैव मे नैव मात्सर्यभाव न धर्मो न चार्थो न कामो न मोक्ष चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं न पुण्यं न पापं न सौख्यं न दुःखम् न मन्त्रो न तीर्थं न वेदा न यज्ञा अहं भोजनं नैव भोज्यं न भोक्ता चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं अहं निर्विकल्पो निराकाररूपो विभूत्वाच्च सर्वत्र सर्वेन्द्रियाणां न चासङ्गतं नैव मुक्तेन मे चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं शिवोऽहं चिदानन्दरूपा शिवोऽहं 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 शिवोऽहं